Civilization doesn't give you a leg up on this stuff. In fact, it makes it harder to figure out what's going on, because we have defined nature as dead. You know, atoms screaming through empty space, ruled by tensor equations of the third degree. That's our picture of what nature is. That isn't what it is. It's a mind of some sort. Okay, what is the implication of all this? Is this just some kind of fringe-o anthropological revisionism? No, it isn't, because the fall into history and its consequences is, at this point, a loaded gun held to the head of the entire planet. We are about to pull over the soup cauldron. And if we do this, then 2.5 billion years of evolutionary advance will be shot. Nobody else ever dropped the ball. So, you know, we appear to be vying for this peculiar honor. If we do not awaken to the consequences of ego, then we are going to run this system right over the edge. The whole thing which characterizes our dilemma as a global society is our inability to feel the consequences of what we are doing. You know, we've got the data. The ozone hole is disappearing. The planktonic life in the sea will die if it does. That will disrupt the food chain. The world food supply will drop by 60%. Everybody who isn't white as a sheet will have to starve in that case. And so forth and so on. I mean, we actually toy not only with our own extinction, but with the extinction of all life on the planet and with the extinction of the idea of dignity and decency itself. Well, I'm not in this psychedelic game because I think it's easy or because I think it's going to be a cinch. I'm in it because I think it's the only game in town. You know, if hortatory preaching could have done the trick, then the Sermon on the Mount would have turned the corner. If cautionary data flowing back to ruling institutions could do the trick, then sometime after Thomas Malthus, people would have begun to hit the brakes. Nothing seems to work. We're sick. We need pharmacological intervention. The ego is permitting us to slowly, not so slowly, commit suicide. And, you know, the fact that we cannot act collectively, that we are suspicious of all forms of collectivism, that we really are all for one and one for all is not our style. Instead, what we have going is a catfight. And, you know, no less a straight person than Arthur Koestler, in a book called The Ghost in the Machine, said, humans are so wired for beating the brains out of woolly mastodons, that's what evolution has equipped us to do. Not negotiate weapons treaties and destroy bacteriological factories. We have to force our evolution. We have to chemically restructure the primate brain so that we do not commit suicide. And the only way to do it in the time left is for the psychedelic community to stand up on its hind legs and roar. And, you know, maybe they'll build camps for us. But the point being, I think there's a moral imperative to try what works. I mean, you know, in the 60s, psychedelics were called consciousness-expanding drugs. A good old phenomenological description. Well, if consciousness does not loom large in the future history of our species, then what the hell kind of future is it going to be? No future at all, I maintain. So if there is even the slightest iota of possibility that these things do what I'm saying they do, then we need to get Johnny Quick on it and check it out. because we may be beyond the point of no return right now. Nobody knows how bad this ozone hole thing is, or what's locked up at Rocky Flats, or behind the Iron Curtain, or dumped in the Arctic Ocean. We may be past the fail-safe point right now, folks. There is no time to lose. It is time to engage the powers that be in a little more serious dialogue than the just say no horseshit that's been peddled recently, because we're talking about the survival of life on the only planet that we are at certain has life on it. This may be the site of a cosmic experiment with universal implications. And it rests in our hands. Everybody here tonight is here because a whole bunch of people didn't drop the ball. And, you know, you think you've got problems? 9 times in the last 1,000,000 years, the ice has moved south from the poles, miles thick. No antibiotics. No electronic communication. Nothing. And I'm sure these people were miserable, and they dragged through it, and they lived, and they passed it on. Now we're it. And we will be judged the lamest of the lame if we cannot come to terms with this and begin to talk about what is going on. This is not obscure. As I said, I view the psychedelic experience as central to humanness, as our sexuality. We cannot allow dominator institutions to infantilize us and to tell you where your mind can and cannot go. We even have a piece of paper locked up in a vault in Washington, D.C. that guarantees life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, now, what could the pursuit of happiness possibly mean if it doesn't mean the freedom to practice your own relationship to nature and its gifts? So I think we have been entirely too casual about the importance of the psychedelic experience. This is for one reason, because we cannot publicly get together and discuss it in detail. And one of the things that I think is very important about get-togethers like this is if you will look around, you'll notice that we cannot really be distinguished from the rest of society. Some of us live under bridges, some of us clip coupons. There's a wide spectrum of people here. But this is your affinity group. This is your community. Someone in this room actually has what you need. And, you know, I have acted as a filter, so out of millions living along the Front Range, here we've gotten it down to 200. I can't go any further than that, folks. The rest is up to you. Well, I guess the last thing I want to say, and then we'll take a little intermission and then come back and do questions afterwards, which is my favorite part. But I want to just for a minute invoke the psychedelic experience without regard to the evolutionary forces that created it or the political institutions that suppress it and so forth, and just say, in case there's some soul in this room who's never had this experience, that this is extraordinary news. We are not talking about something like a dream. It is not like meditation. No, you can't get there by yourself. And Babaji is equally useless, because you and Babaji are starting from the same place in this game. It requires pharmacological perturbation of ordinary neurochemistry in order to see this mystery. And it is a mystery. It is not going to be reduced to the firing of synapses or repressed sexual desires or day residues or anything like that. It is the very thing which all these religions are yammering about. It's there. It's real. I mean, if you think that the world is empty of adventure, then you just haven't been hanging out with the right crowd. I mean, on a Saturday night, within the confines of your own apartment, on 5 grams of psilocybin mushrooms in silent darkness, I guarantee you, you will believe that Ferdinand Magellan should take second place to you. You will see things which no human being has ever seen before, and that no human being will ever see again. That's how big that universe is. The incredibly constricted space-time locus of the here and now that evolution has forced upon us for survival purposes is simply one point in an apparently infinite hologram of explorable data that is the human world. I mean, the entire world of every science fiction novel and story ever written is minuscule compared to the universes of strangeness and peculiarity that are accessible to any one of us, if you will but apply the method. And if you're not willing to apply the method, then, you know, you're going to sweep up around the ashram till hell freezes over and not understand what is going on. I mean, I think, I'm sorry to be so hard on religion. I think it has its place. Its place is the inspiration of ethical behavior. You know, religion should teach ethical behavior. But it has very, very little to say about the mystery of being other than that it's there. And that's not practicing religion. Practicing religion is dancing with the mystery, losing and finding yourself in the mystery. And people often say to me, you know, well, how does this relate to other forms of spiritual work? Well, the answer is maybe not at all. I mean, I've certainly taken a lot of psychedelics, and I think I see no sign of spiritual attainment or ethical perfection or anything so la-di-da as that. I don't know what this is all about, but I do know it's ours. It belongs to us. We are the creatures of mind, and 95% of what mind is lies on the other side of the psychedelic boundary. Ordinary consciousness is just like keeping the accounts of life, but there's more to life than the account books. I mean, everything else is out there: the color, the affection, the humor, the terror, the mystery, the incredible strangeness of it all. This is the domain that we want to claim and explore, and if we can find the collective institutional courage to do it, I think this current planetary crisis will be seen for what it really is. And what it is it's not a dying. These are not the last rites for intelligence. This is a birth process. I mean, if you were to come around, if you'd never seen somebody give birth and you came around the corner and it was in progress, you would be thoroughly, profoundly alarmed. I mean, it looks like an enormous tumor is making its way out of somebody, and they are being split in two, and blood is being shed, and there's pleading and screaming and thrashing. It would be a real leap of understanding for you to say, oh, how wonderful, new life is emerging. This is the way we do it. Well, this is the way we do it. I mean, we are in the birth canal right now of a planetary civilization. Literally, the amniotic oceans of 500 years ago, that's all gone. There is no frontier. There is no going back. The peace of the fetal environment is gone, and now in transition, literally, the walls are closing in. You can't breathe, you can't eat, you can't find your way. It appears to be the end, but there's light at the end of the tunnel. The problem is that tunnel is in the back of your mind, and if you don't go to the back side of your mind, you will never see the light at the end of the tunnel. And once you see it, then the task becomes to empower it in yourself and other people. Spread it as a reality. God did not retire to the seventh heaven. God is some kind of lost continent in the human mind. And if we will but explore the human mind, we can reclaim these relationships with our own authenticity and shed the childishness of historical existence and gender politics and all the rest of it, and move on to the real business of establishing a real civilization. Thank you very much. Does anyone want to ask a question, or is it all just perfectly clear, utterly convincing, and, yeah?
Are there bad effects?
Of psilocybin? Bad effects. Somebody once said, what's wrong with DMT? And I said, well, nothing unless you fear death by astonishment. But your question is a good one. First of all, you know, I talked a lot about how what we have to do is destroy and ablate ego. However, there is a very small percentage of us who have a hard time creating any ego whatsoever. And for these people, boundary dissolution is no problem. Their boundaries are dissolving all the time on them. I would say that they are at the contraindicated end of the spectrum. That if you're fearful already and fighting to keep from being overwhelmed by confusion at what's going on in your life at the paper box factory or something, then probably tossing in mega doses of hallucinogens is not the way for you to do it. Or if you do, if you're just bent on doing that, then I would say do it in the presence of some kind of professional. And how you find a professional in this legal climate, you'll have to discuss with me privately. I don't want to make it sound, though. I mean, it's a tricky thing. I don't want to make it sound like it's absolutely riskless. Physically, I think it's pretty safe, unless you are odd in some way. But you need to know, you know, you don't want to find out you're odd an hour and a half into it. But the problem comes with the mind. You know, if you are delicately balanced, if your whole life has been about not looking at that or that or that, then this is not your game. You know, you should go back to watching Jeopardy. And the kind of person who is called to this is a person who has an exploring soul. I mean, I am not a courageous person in the sense that you won't find me shooting white water. You don't see me, you know, rappelling down the faces of cliffs. But from the time I was the tiniest little kid, I was into the weird. What's weird? Weird is the compass heading. And if you keep your compass always pointed toward the peculiar, the outre, the bizarre, the unspeakably alien, then, you know, you'll find these places. The people who think life is all cut and dried and are perfectly happy to have Carl Sagan and George Bush explain all of reality have never left the broad, swift stream of mundane thinking. But, you know, off in the byways and tributaries, there's a wonderful alchemical saying, which I generally mangle, but I think it goes something like this. The tallest mountains, the oldest books, the widest deserts. There you will find the stone. And what it is it's a prescription for exploring weirdness. That's all. It's not going to be on MTV. It's not going to be in, God forbid, Esquire. It's going to come from, you know, doing your homework, visiting strange people in strange lands, and checking it out. What I can't give you, to return to your question, is I can't give you a guarantee that it will be fun. You know, the Rolling Stones have that wonderful line, you don't get what you want, you get what you need. This stuff is ruthless. And if there's something that you're trying not to look at, it's going to get you, for sure. But ask the veterans. Most people will tell you, you learn more from the bad trips than you do from the good ones. The good ones are ecstatic and connect you up to nature and other people. The bad ones show you your kinks and your limitations and your thought errors and that sort of thing. It's not an easy row to hoe. That's why I think there's a little bit of social confusion about it. One of the things I should make clear is I really advocate high doses rarely. I think the worst thing you can do is get into a style of psychedelic diddling where, you know, you take half a gram every day. Well, all this is doing is giving you a tolerance to psilocybin. You're not having the psilocybin experience. You're having the tolerance to psilocybin experience. The way to do these things is to do them rarely so that your whole system can reassert itself and come to equilibrium, and then just slam it. And this is amazing. I mean, I think that this works for all these psychedelics. I'm an inveterate cannabis user, and I wish in a way that I could get a slightly better grip on my cannabis use, because I think the real way to do cannabis is like once a week by yourself in silent darkness with the strongest stuff you can get and then immense amounts of it. And, you know, people call it a recreational drug and a this and a that. Hey, done that way, it will catapult you into places where I love it. The great place to get to on cannabis, and some people never in their whole life touch it, is the place where you say, my God, I've done too much. It's not easy, folks, but it's worth shooting for. Basically, what you should do is, you know, do some homework, read some books, talk to your friends, and then hang on, Hannah. It's like, you know, it's very much like riding an enormous roller coaster. You know, once that baby rolls out of the station, do not stand up. Do not try to climb out of your car. Shut up and hang on with the faith that most people have lived through this. Somebody else. Yeah. The purple.
Yeah, I have three real quick literary questions about your writing and then one important question.
Well, having just heard that I'm a pothead, please ask them one at a time. What is your first literary question?
Okay. One of the assertions that you make is that low dosage was the typical evolutionary mechanism. My own experience is different than that. Many of my associates' experiences are different than that. And we believe that high dosage may have been the more common usage method.
Well, I don't mean to imply that people first used it in low doses and then middle and then higher over time. What I meant to imply, I think they were using low, middle, and high doses from the very get-go, but they were using low doses to hunt, middle-range doses for orgy and ceremony, and truly high doses for this boundary-dissolving tremendum. Second literary question.
Okay. When I read about Chao Haya, I liked you picking up on Mallard and Eisler, and I liked your use of dominator and partnership terminology. That was wonderful. But I disagreed when you said that the cows were an indirect expression of the fungus found in the art there. I found that to be kind of a leap of logic. But my train of thought has gone off the rails of reason enough.
Well, I'm not wedded to that. First of all, Chattal Hyuk, for those of you who haven't read the book or know about Chattal, was this immensely sophisticated civilization that existed in the 7th millennium BC. We're talking 6,000 years before zero. This civilization existed and was destroyed, and the characteristic of it is shrines dedicated to cattle. And in my book, I argue that this was probably the last outpost of this partnership society. But it was still, I think, the real golden age of mushroom use was probably from about 30,000 years ago to about 15,000 years ago. And by the time Chattal Hyuk comes along, it's a fading or yearly or seasonal thing.
And the last question, the important one. One of the assertions that you made earlier was that these indole-based plant hallucinogens actually changed people that used them. And the unfortunate thing that I observed is I can't agree with that assertion. It seems that as many people, it seems like only a really few people are changed by it. Only those who are predisposed to change. And I'd like, one of the questions you ask, does it make us better? Does it make us different? And I'm just not convinced at all. When I see people taking mushrooms and going around doing chingus-mingus things and just being as jerky as they ever were, I mean, and going to get drugs and using weapons plants, and, you know, I don't see it happening. I'm sorry.
Well,
My
argument would be that people don't take it enough, and they don't take it frequently enough. That there are a lot of people who really would rather not get loaded, but who feel they must take some psychedelic drug in order to keep membership in their peer group. So what they do, you know, you can always spot these people because their first question at the get-go is, will I be able to drive? I love this question because, you know, it indicates you've got a real tough nut on your hand. In every sense of the word, no, you will not be able to drive. One of the things that inspires me to do this is I want to get to the people who've taken 3 grams of mushrooms and the people who've taken 150 mics of LSD. And I want to convince those people that they never got close to what I'm talking about, even though they had a life-transforming experience and saw things totally differently. They never got close to what I'm talking about. And so what you have to do is convince people to take high doses, and then that's to break them through, and then frequently enough that they don't forget what the deal is. So I think if you take a psychedelic population and divide it into those who have done 5 grams and above, then you will see an exceptional slice. But not the dabblers. The dabblers don't count. And we all can be, or at times, guilty of this, I think. And then, is that your last question? Does that do it for you? Or do you want to be thought psychotic? You choose.
I will not occupy your position in this room.
Well, I'd love competition. I mean, the competition is terrible. That's the entire basis of my success. Yeah. You, because you were before, if you still wish.
Here's the way you like to think it. You like to understand, get a darkened room, quiet, cancel your eyes. Now, look at the fact that Leary and Milberg can't figure out whether they play tape, so they got the book in the bin, and we generally allow them to do that. And a lot of people think that they play the best in their life.
Right.
And why?
Why? Because, I mean, I don't know if it's preferable, but here's the thing. People are going to think you're a nut if you come down and say that Johann Sebastian Bach or Jerry Garcia is God. And this is what you will have to say if you listen to The Dead or the B minor Mass. So what I'm interested in I want to know the thing in itself, not what it does to Bach, not what it does to a river flowing through a forested valley. I want to see what it can do with darkness and silence. And I think most people think it'll be boring, probably because they've been hanging out with these beady-eyed gurus meditating, and God knows there's nothing more boring on earth than most meditations. However, sitting in a darkened room on 5 dried grams of psilocybin mushrooms is nothing like meditating. And that's where it can get at you. My relationship to it is always one of, I want to know what it is. And so I think this sensory deprivation method is the only way to get at that. Other people might not like that. People say, well, you mean you put down the whole thing of going into nature? Isn't nature the great affirmation in all this? And the answer is, yeah, but it works for me sort of without the drugs. Plus, and this is just maybe my own weirdness, but I'll share it with you, I have noticed that these things are incredibly disruptive of the ordinary flow of casuistry. Do you all know the concept synchronicity? Well, if you don't stay in your room with the lights out and the phone unplugged, and the damnedest things will happen to you. I mean, you couldn't pay me to go into an American city, even mildly loaded, because adventures beckon. Now, some people like that, you know. Some people say, you know, let's take 500 mics and go meet weird people. not this cookie. Yeah.
In replying to your statement about the feeling of darkness, what I find happens there is that you create an experience where you are taking in other people's dogma. You know, you're bringing in something that's already done, and I feel like the peak experience is when you create something new, as something new expresses itself from the depths of the being, which is why I also say the darkness sometimes. But one thing that I did learn is that the high doses are very, very interesting. It would take me way far beyond the small doses. And I've experimented with both homeopathy and natural medicine and herbal extracts in terms of making my own medicine. But in terms of psychedelics, if you take that into, and my question is coming back, sorry. If you take that into a situation where you remove the whole molecular pattern that you do in homeopathy, do you think that there could be a more potent experience through that evolution?
Are you asking me, do I think a homeopathic preparation of a psychedelic would be effective? It would be homeopathically effective. I wouldn't expect it to be experientially effective.
See, I would say that since what we view out here is a direct creation, what we are inside, that the current paradigm might be that if you do change it in the same manner that you change your homeopathy, which is changing the etheric so that you then create the gross material star, that it would be even more potent and even more immediately effective, reconstructing their reality.
But don't you think that if that were true, and since in a high dilution like that, no molecular trace of the original compound remains, that you have then just found the solution to the legalization conundrum?
Yeah, I kind of believe that, because one thing that we're noticing in the field of criminal medicine now is that we're getting a lot of political flack for having medicines out there, but homeopathy is skimming through and stayed as it has for many years.
Because in a materialist world, it's assumed to be bogus.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, this seems to me not an abstract proposition at all. Let the best homeopaths succuss the strongest hallucinogens and set them out, and let's give it a whirl. Over on this side, yeah.
This question may be too personal and embarrassing to answer, but I'm just really...
Oh, I can hardly wait.
Why are you in jail?
Why am I not in jail? Well, that's an interesting question. Number one, I don't know. Here's what I've come up with. Notice that I use big words. I don't try to boil it down to a shoutable slogan. Like turn on, tune in, drop out. Then they come. They come. So that's one possibility, that simply if you are defined in their eyes as an intellectual, then they automatically put you in the harmless category and send resources elsewhere. That's one possibility. Now, the other possibility is slightly more disturbing, but in the interests of thoroughness, let me raise it. Perhaps I'm sanctioned. Perhaps they decided, we don't really understand what this stuff is, and we can't have a mass movement. But let one guy just kind of keep the pilot light on in case we ever change our minds about this. He will have kept the pilot light on. And the other possibility, which is probably too naive, but in the interest, again, of exhaustive thoroughness, maybe they just haven't noticed yet. You know, Tim Leary, who's a friend of mine, would address 25,000 people at a throw. My crowds are, a couple of times a year, they creep over 1,000. And I think the key is to keep it low key. And we don't want to, Dodger Stadium filled or anything like that. It's very good to atomize it and spread it through. Now, the other thing is, I advocate plant hallucinogens. And people always say, well, what about LSD? I mean, didn't LSD change your life? Didn't it change all our lives? Why aren't you into LSD? And the answer is certainly yes and yes. The reason I'm not into LSD is not having to do with the effects of LSD, which I think are marvelous, but with the fact that a couple of enterprising second-year biochemistry students can produce 6 or 7 million hits in a long weekend. 6 or 7 million hits of an illegal drug? Suddenly, this is the realm of governments and criminal syndicates and revolutionary disruption of populations. My brother and I wrote Psilocybin, the Magic Mushroom Grower's Guide. If you work like a dog for 6 months, maybe you can produce 2 or 3,000 hits. So that's the thing. LSD had chemical qualities that made it terrifying to the government. I mean, anybody with $50,000 worth of backing and two years of biochemistry could turn themselves into a major threat to political stability in this country. So they slammed that. They're not going to put up with that. The thing I love about the mushrooms is, you know, if you're a dedicated mushroom grower, you produce this piddling amount. And if they come and drag you away because it is illegal, all they get is you. No syndicate collapses, no pyramid disappears. So it's invasive and low-key and slowly spreading. The other thing is, mushrooms are, this is a cultural thing, mushrooms are inherently non-threatening. They're absurd. You know, they're what we put decals of on serving trays, and bath towels bear mushrooms on them. It's a kind of silly thing, and so I think that they don't really understand what a powerful hallucinogen this is. Well, that's enough on why I'm not in the can. This woman, yeah.
You spoke about the evolutionary process and how it was disturbed by the absence of the mushrooms. Don't you think that it would be a more creative and beneficial process if we worked on evolving our minds without using an external drug? What happens if the government does come in and decide to completely wipe it out, or if things happen where we can't access that state of consciousness anymore, and then things, you know, they just step backwards again? Wouldn't it be so much more productive to teach people how to get there without the drug?
Absolutely, if we could do it. I mean, I'm not yet convinced, see? I mean, you've got your gurus. But if you ever get close to any of these people in these guru scenes, close enough where you can just say to them, look, level with me. Is this stuff as good as 5 grams in silent darkness? And they say, huh, are you serious? The other possibility is technology on two fronts, mind machines. The problem with mind machines is, you know, you have to smoke a bomber to put up with it more than 10 minutes. I mean, you quickly satisfy yourself that this can't possibly be it, because it is lights, and it is contentless, while the psychedelic experience is all content. The other possibility, and I've put in some time in this beat, is a virtual reality. And I have more hope for virtual reality, because virtual reality is a technology that would allow us to show each other the inside of our heads, our dreams, our visions. And I think that sufficiently perfected, it might have the consequences of these psychedelics. The problem is, it carries a huge amount of negative freight. You know that it's not going to be a tool for us to show each other the inside of our minds. It's going to be a tool to sell us crap that we don't want. It's going to be a tool for yet more realistic, vicarious, and gratuitous violence. It's going to be a tool for more pornographic degradation of women. So it seems to me, while it holds out the possibility of a technically driven psychedelic, it has a lot of negative freight. I agree with your premise, but I'm driven by a tremendous sense of urgency. I mean, why try to create a technical alternative to psilocybin when you've got psilocybin?
Not the technical alternative, I'm saying, like, I think that people should use mushrooms as a step. And once you get there, you try and you keep going without that tool. I mean, because what we want is, I mean, we want to transcend this plane. We want to be on a higher plane, a higher state of awareness. That you're not going to get to that plane ultimately if you have to keep coming back into the plane to get the stuff to get out of the plane again.
Well, how about? How about this? Maybe there's something wrong with that metaphor, because notice it has to do with planes and transitions. It's an inherently dualist metaphor.